So what are those things that stand in your way of enjoying life? COVID-19 stands in the way of enjoying your life. How does it do that?
Too much fear, too many rules.
Too much separation. Too many restrictions.
Infringement on liberty.
Infringement on liberty. What stands in the way of you enjoying life?
Sin.
One. Stands in your way of enjoying life. Other people.
Fear.
It's interesting, the things that you say, and we tend to focus on the things that are getting in the way of me enjoying my life, are all the things that we wish that are exterior to our life that we could change, because if we could change the things that are going on around us, our life would be so much better, wouldn't it? The interesting thing about that is what God tells us, that in spite of the things that are going on around us, we can enjoy life. Isn't that what Jesus did? He was able to enjoy his life in spite of the things that other people said, in spite of how people were trying to impose their rules on him. And isn't it interesting, as you listen to that section out of Deuteronomy, are we really any different from the Israelites who resist and push back against any rules that infringe on our liberty of us doing what we want to do when we want to do it? And isn't that exactly at the heart of what Deuteronomy is saying to this generation of people who their parents rebelled against God? And God says, well, if you want to live your life without me, I will let you do that. I'll still provide for you. But if you're going to resist and rebel, I won't bring you into the land flowing with milk and honey. I will let you continue to have a proximity with me, but you really won't have much of a relationship with me because your hearts are hard. It's because they didn't like the rules. Their freedoms were infringed on. They couldn't understand how these things were actually to their good and be content with that. Last week we talked about contentment. What are those things that get in the way of us being content? Most of it is us thinking, well, it should be different. Life should be different. People should be different. I should be different. God should be different. So when we are like the Israelites, a people in Deuteronomy, this new generation, we're really a lot different from their ancestors, because they were complainers too. They were resistant too. But God is a God of promise. He says, I will bring you into this land, not because you deserve it, but because I have promised it. And if you want to be a part of my overarching goal, my overarching desire for humanity, I will bring you into this land that you don't deserve, and I will present it to you, and then how will your heart respond to that? This promised land wasn't heaven, was it? This wasn't going to be a land where all problems were going to be taken away, that they were just going to be able to move in and not have challenges. But isn't it interesting that at the end of that passage of Scripture, he says, you're going to enjoy some things that you did not do. You will be blessed by the work of other peoples. But because they were hardened in heart, because they rejected me, I have pushed them out of this land, this good land flowing with milk and honey, and I'm going to present it to you. Now, how will you respond to receive this blessing? Because I am so gracious and I am so loving. It's kind of like being born into family, isn't it? Is that we're born into families and all of a sudden we have food, hopefully. Hopefully we have clothes. Hopefully we have shelter. Hopefully we have compassion and care. But isn't it interesting when that's all we know, we take it for granted? Not until we don't have the things that are just offered to us out of the blue or because they have to. God says, I will provide these things for you. But just like we as kids growing up don't know much different about what the world has to offer, we can become frustrated because obviously we always want it to be more. We want it to be different, and we want it to be without rules and regulations so that we can do it our way. And isn't that the consistent problem that we humans have with our relationship to God? He wanted to bless them. He wanted to utilize them. In this promised land was the staging area that God was going to use to bless the world. And when we're thinking about Deuteronomy, we're going to watch a summary of Deuteronomy here. And I want you to think, as you're watching this, as I am on my journey, how am I similar to these people? And what do I need to do so that I don't just repeat old patterns and old habits?
The book of Deuteronomy is the fifth book of the Bible and the final book of the Torah. After the exodus from Egypt, Israel was at Mount Sinai for 1 year, entering into a covenant with their God. And then they had the disastrous road trip through the wilderness, and the Exodus generation disqualified themselves from entering into the land promised to Abraham. And so Deuteronomy begins with Moses standing in front of this new generation explaining the Torah. And it's from here that the design and purpose of the book unfolds. Deuteronomy is a series of speeches from Moses where he's calling the next generation of Israel to be faithful to the covenant with their God. At the center of the book is a collection of laws, which are the terms of the covenant between God and Israel. Some of the laws are new, but many are repeated from the laws given earlier at Mount Sinai. And that's actually where this book gets its name, from a Greek word, deuteronomion, which means a second law. Now, surrounding these laws are two outer sections of Moses' speech. Each of these are broken up into two parts themselves. Let's just dive in and we'll see how this whole thing works. So Moses, first of all, summarizes the story so far, and he highlights how rebellious the previous generation was, in contrast with God's constant grace and provision in the wilderness. And God did bring his justice on them, yes, but he did not abandon his covenant promises. After this comes a series of very passionate sermons where Moses calls on this new generation to be more faithful than their parents were to the covenant. He reminds them of the Ten Commandments, and then the centerpiece of this section is a famous line called the Shema. Moses says, "Listen, Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord alone, and you shall love the Lord your God with all of your heart, with all of your soul, and with all of your might." This became a very important daily prayer in Judaism, and it brings all of the themes of the book together. So the word listen, or shema in Hebrew, it means much more than just to hear. Its meaning includes responding to what you hear, or in English we would say obey. And the word love in Hebrew also means much more than just an emotion or feeling. It's about a decision of wholehearted devotion to God that involves your will and your emotions, your mind and your heart. Now, for Israel, their obedience and devotion to God served a much larger purpose. Obedience to the laws is going to make Israel a unique people among the nations. Just like God said at Mount Sinai, they will become a kingdom of priests. And Moses now says, how? Israel has the chance, by following the laws, to show the whole world the wisdom and the justice of God. The other key idea in the Shema is that Israel was called to obey and be devoted to the Lord alone. Or literally, in Hebrew, it says, the Lord is one. Now, in context, the point is that the Lord is the one God Israel is to worship and obey. Israel's about to go into the land of Canaan, where people worship idol gods that represent all different aspects of creation, the sun, the weather, sex, and war. And in Moses' view, worshiping these gods degrades humans and destroys communities. But worshiping the God of Israel, who's the creator and the redeemer, that will lead to life and blessing. And so we come to the large collection of laws at the center of the book. And they're roughly arranged by topic. So the opening section is about Israel's worship of their God. They were to have one central temple where one God would be worshipped. And also, God was to be worshipped in Israel's care for its poor. So, for example, all Israelites were to set aside 1/10 of their annual income to be given to the temple. But another 10th was to be set aside every 3 years and given to the poor. And these are the kinds of laws that put Israel on the cutting edge of justice in comparison to their ancient neighbors. And it was all bound up with their worship of God. The next section outlines the character qualities of Israel's leaders. So the elders, the priests, the kings, these were all placed under the authority of the covenant laws, which God said that he would enforce by sending prophets to keep the leaders accountable. So in contrast to Israel's neighbors, where kings were thought of as divine and a law unto themselves, Israel's leaders were subordinate to the law and the prophets. Following this is a large section of laws about Israel's civil life, so rules about marriage and family and business, and also about social justice, about their legal system and how it was to protect widows and orphans and immigrants. And then these are concluded by more laws about worship. Now, here's some tips for reading all of these laws. Remember, first of all, these are the terms of the Sinai covenant given specifically to ancient Israel, living in a culture that's very different from yours. And so, two, it's not going to be helpful to compare these laws with modern laws from a very different culture. Rather, these were given to set Israel apart. And so we need to compare these laws with those of Israel's neighbors, like in Assyria or Babylon. And when you do that, all of a sudden, laws that seemed harsh or bizarre become much more clear. You see that God is pushing Israel to a higher level of justice than was ever known before. And so finally, try to discern what core principles of wisdom or justice underlie any particular law, and you'll discover some really profound things. So here's an extra credit assignment. Go see how Paul the Apostle does this very thing in his first letter to the Corinthians, chapter 9, verse 9, and he quotes a law from Deuteronomy, chapter 25, verse 4. It's really interesting. So back to Moses. After he goes through all of the laws, he issues a final challenge that Israel should listen to and love their God. He first issues a warning and an ultimatum. If Israel listens to and obeys their God, everything's going to go great, lots of divine blessing. But if they don't listen and rebel, famine, plague, devastation, and ultimately exile from the land. And then Moses forces a decision. He says, "Today I set before you all life or death, blessing or curse, goodness or evil, so choose life by loving the Lord your God and listening to him." But then Moses says this. He says, "I know that after I die, you're going to rebel and turn away from God and end up in exile," which is kind of a downer. But then again, he's been with these people for decades, and it becomes clear that his hopes are not very high. "But all is not lost," Moses says. "One day, when Israel is sitting in exile, at any point," Moses says, "they can turn back to their God, who will," in his words, "circumcise your hearts so that you may love him with all your heart and soul and live." Now, this is a vivid metaphor that's saying something is fundamentally wrong with Israel's heart. It's stubborn and hard. And it's the same thing wrong with the heart of all of humanity. This is going all the way back to the rebellion in the garden. Humans seized autonomy from God. They wanted to define good and evil for themselves, and they ruined God's good world as a result. But one day, Moses says, God is going to do something to transform the hearts of his people so that they can truly listen to and love God from the heart and be led back to true life. And this is the promise that gets picked up by the later biblical prophets, Jeremiah and Ezekiel, the hope for a new heart. So Moses ends his speech with a poem of warning and then of blessing, and then he walks up onto a mountain and he dies. And so the Torah draws to a close. All of the major plot tensions of the biblical story are in place, but left totally unresolved. So when is the descendant of the woman going to come and defeat evil? Or how is God going to rescue the whole world and bless all nations through this family? And how can God's holiness be reconciled with people who are continually rebellious? And how is God going to transform the hearts of his people? You just have to keep reading to find out. But for now, that's what the book of Deuteronomy is all about.
Heart, with all your mind, with all your strength. He's able to ask that because that's what he offers us. He loves his creation, his people, with his entire being. Even when they resist him, even when they're rebellious to him, he is gracious to them. He pursues them and he leaves it up to them. He doesn't force them into this relationship. He calls them. He says, if this is the kind of relationship you want, this is the kind of relationship I promise to have with you. But the challenge is our heart, isn't it? Our heart. It can be deceitful. It can tell us things that we want or need when we really don't need them, or when we get them, we really don't want them. And isn't that challenging as well? Because in that, he talked about wisdom. We think we're wise and we understand what we need, but we really don't. We need God, who created all things, to inform us what we need, when we need it, and how much of it we need. But the challenge that the people were going to have as they entered into this new land was very specific. It's about other gods. One of the things that modernism has tended to do is eliminate a spiritual world, to make us think that all there is the physical. The only thing that really is what we can see, but we also realize that there are enemies that we can't see. This COVID virus. You put under a microscope and see it, but you can't see it with your own eyes. Because of that, we realize there's more to this world than meets the eye. And one of the things God says is that you're going to be challenged with these other gods. Other gods? Are there really other gods? Well, we're told that there is a spiritual realm and that God exists in it, and that this spiritual realm is often obvious in the earthly realm. That there can be angels working, God is working, Jesus came from that spiritual realm. So there is this intertwining between the two, but you can't see it with your physical eyes. You can only see it from a spiritual heart. In these other gods, you might read about them in history classes, about the Roman gods, the Greek gods, the Egyptian gods, the Samaritan gods, all these different aspects that are out there that are related to human life, things that people worshipped because they wanted their crops to grow, they wanted to have children, they wanted to be in relationships, they wanted to be secure. All the things that we tend to want. And these gods were there to be appeased or manipulated one way or another so that you could get these things. But when you think about the pantheon of the gods, they wanted to be worshipped, but they were often very manipulative. These gods were much like humans. Their characteristics were much like ours, but they didn't have the consequences to their actions that we did. Wouldn't we like that? To be able to do things and not pay a price. Because one of the things that these gods would do is they would cause humanity to pay a price. So therefore, we have to appease these gods. But God says there is only one ultimate God, and you are the apple of his eye. You are the object of his love. You are the desire of his heart. And he desires for us to be at peace. He desires for us to be in harmony. He desires for us to be content. But what happens is when we take our eye away from the one overarching, ultimate God, that's when our contentment starts to go away. That's when we start to climb upon the thrones of our own lives. And this one God is so much different from the small g gods of the world. And these gods were there because of the things that they could do, the things they could manipulate, the rain, the sun, the moon. And this one God is beyond all things. And he tells the people in Exodus 20, the very first law, there's only one God, ultimate God. But he doesn't eliminate the fact that there are other small g forces out there. David Wright, he writes this, the first commandment does not insist that other gods are not existent, but that they are powerless. It disenfranchises them. Oh. So God is saying there are spiritual forces out there, but he is the one who is overarching and all-powerful over all of them. It does not simply say that they should not be worshipped. It leaves them with no status worthy of worship. And if that's the case, then why do we worship these lower level gods? Oftentimes it's because we pray to the overarching God and we're not getting what we want when we want it. So we thought, how can I get that in a different way? And people use different means. The thrust of the verse in Exodus 20 is not Yahweh's sole deity, but Yahweh's sole sovereignty over his people and over the world. God is sovereign. We have to trust that. But Paul tells us in Ephesians that our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but principalities and powers against authorities of the dark world. And against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms. There's a battle going on, folks. And when we forget that reality, that interconnection between the physical and the spiritual, then we will only perceive our life through a physical lens. But God says, no, I don't want you to do that because you will be fooled. You'll be manipulated to think that there's other ways for you to be satisfied and content and be frustrated by the world around you and not find this peace that I want for you. He says, you trust in me. Paul also says about these sacrifices that were offered to these idols. He says, these idols are nothing and these gods are no gods. But what you do when you offer sacrifices to these idols, you're actually worshiping demons. So when we set up idols and gods in our life, we're not serving the God of gods. We're serving something so much different. And ultimately, it's self-serving. And these demons like that. They want us to continue doing that. But one of the things we realize that when we were dead in our transgressions and the uncircumcision of our flesh and our hardness of hearts, the God who made you alive with Christ, he forgave all our sin, having canceled the charges of our legal indebtedness. All these things stood against us and condemned us. He's taken it all away. He's nailed it to the cross. He's disarmed those powers if we let him. He's disarmed all those authorities if we let him. And he made a public spectacle of them, triumphing over them by the cross. When the people looked at the cross and thought it was Jesus who was triumphed over, Jesus has the last word, Jesus has the last laugh. When the tomb flies open, and he's alive. And those powers have no power over him. So what are these gods of the world today? Kyle Eidelman, he says that there are gods. It's not in a religious form like we would think, but they're gods nonetheless. The gods of comfort. We turn to entertainment. The god of significance. We turn to our career and our accomplishments. The god of security, we look to control or money. The god of joy, we look to relationships. The god of hope, we look to politicians and legislators. The god of truth, we look to popular opinion and academic consensus. All these things aren't bad in themselves, comfort, significance, security, joy, hope, truth. None of those are bad. But God says, seek them in me. No other place. And we set up these temples in our heart, these temples of pleasure. More food, more entertainment, more copulation, feeling good. The temple of power, success and money and achievement. The temple of love, romance, family, and me. And God doesn't want you not to love yourself. He just says, don't love yourself more than you love me. Because I love you. But when you start loving yourself more than you love me, then you become the God, and I am no longer your God. But the blessing that we have is when Jesus told the apostles when he was going to leave, he says, I'm going to leave, but I'm going to leave you with hope. He says, you believe me, and God loves you for that. He is so glad that you come to understand that I was sent by him. And because you understand his love, you can grasp his love, and you will love him in return. He says, I came from the Father, I came into the world because of his love. Now I'm going to leave this world and go back to him. And the disciples said, oh, okay, now we finally understand what you're talking about. We understand now. And Jesus says, good, I'm glad you believe. I'm glad you understand more fully. He said, the time is coming, and in fact, it has now come, that you're going to be scattered. And I would imagine in their minds, it's like, how is that good for us? How is that going to make me joyful? How is that going to make me content when this group that we had that was so strong and the miracles that you were doing that were so amazing and the people that were affected, you're saying all that's going away. That cannot be good in any stretch of the imagination. And Jesus says, it is the ultimate good. But can we understand it? Do we have to? God says, you need to trust me that it is. So when all the world in your eyes might be falling apart, what do you do but remember that the God who promises is the God that reigns? He says, I've told you all these things. But one of the things that you will realize that I've told you these things so that you may have peace. How do all those things bring peace? Because it's from a God of love, a son of love, a promise keeper, a promise maker that we can trust. And in this life, he says, you will have many troubles. He doesn't say, in this life, because of me, I'm going to take them away. Because it's his people that are the staging ground for the world to see that there is a God beyond imagination, beyond our eyes that exists. And he makes himself manifest through our actions, through our loving response to him, and being loving to other people. Because we trust this very simple fact that Jesus has overcome the world. That's what we have to remember when all the exteriors around us that we talked about in the beginning of the lesson, all these things that keep you frustrated from living well, Take your eyes off that stuff. Refocus on the promise that Jesus has overcome the world. Because in Deuteronomy 18, the people were told, I'm going to send a prophet that's like Moses. And Jesus is that prophet. He is that hope to lead us through these challenges. But Jesus always said, also says in Matthew 6:21 that where your treasure is, that is where your heart will be. Who fills your treasure trove? Are you seeking it through God? Or are you seeking it through other means? And it all comes down to the heart. Above all else, guard your heart. For everything you do flows from it. And it is God who doesn't just look at your actions, he looks at the heart that motivates those actions. And in that heart that can be deceptive beyond all things, he says, I will give you a new heart. That's his promise, because we have been made to be a new people. In spite of how we perceive ourselves in our struggle to live up to that standard, he says that you have a new standing before God. But you're going to continue to have those old challenges. But in this new standing with God, as the people of God, you are justified. And God is satisfied because his son has died for us. The loyalty of God should be our goal. What's the means? How do we do this? If the loyalty of God is the goal, how do we do it? I want to hear from you. Okay, so you listen to that portion of Scripture. It's know God. Put these things on your heart. Put them on your forehead. Put them on your door. Talk about them. Immerse yourself in them. Because if you don't immerse yourself in the spiritual realm of what God is offering, you're only going to be immersed in the physical realm. And if the physical realm is all you can see, it's going to be according to the physical realm, is what you do. So we need that prayer. Trust that this God hears us. We need that study so that God can fill us. How else do we achieve the goal?
Fellowship.
And how does the fellowship do that for us, Juan?
To strengthen one another, to build one another up, to encourage one another, to love one another.
To encourage, to love, to build up. And when we think that we're the only ones that's struggling with the old standards, the old challenges, what can we tell one another? You're not alone. That the church is not the place to put on the mask. The church is not the place to be like the world and hide from the reality of who you are. The church is a place where you can come and people can say, you're struggling. I know what that's like. I struggle too. And they might give you ways to and be supported through these challenges rather than going and hunkering down and say, I can't let those people know because they will judge me. They might because of their old heart. But you find those people who aren't going to judge you based on old standards but are going to look at you from this new status that you are a child of God. That's what the church needs to be for one another. How else do we accomplish the means of loyalty to God? Yeah, the Spirit of God, because we can't do this by ourselves. We don't have the wisdom or the strength. And the Spirit of God was sent to us to give us wisdom and strength. Jeff.
Two words, surrender and then obedience.
Surrender and obey, and that goes back to?
It's that not my will, but yours be done. That's the absolute humility for God.
Yeah, and that's the human heart's biggest challenge is humility. Believing that God knows best, and we don't. And we can't listen with a hard heart. Because with a hard heart, we're going to look at all the reasons why the world should be different, why God should be different, why everybody else should be different. And we will become frustrated rather than say, God, I know you understand the world, and I know you understand me, and I'm so blessed when I wake up that I have a roof over my head. I am so blessed that I can go and turn on the faucet and water comes out and I can drink it. I'm so blessed I can open the refrigerator and there's stuff there to eat. God, I am so blessed in so many ways, but from a hard heart, all we look at is what's lacking, not what's been provided. And that's where the gods of this world sneak in. And the gods of this world make you feel the lack of contentment. You want more, don't you? You need more, don't you? But God says, I am all you need, and I will satisfy you. And this is how we accomplish these things in relationship with God. When we see our brokenness, we trust that God has created us in wholeness through the blood of his Son. And it's because of that that we offer him our worship.